From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, how youth justice reform in Wisconsin compares to what's happening in other states. Then, connecting fragments of habitat has caused an annual increase of species in each area, which is surprising even for the scientists.
What we've seen as a result is actually the least likely outcome that we predicted ahead of time. So the fact that it's continued to operate the way that it has been really surprising.
And writer Denise Kiernan explains why she's so intrigued by the colossal Biltmore State Mansion in North Carolina.
I became really curious, not just about, you know, the house and its size, but who had lived there, who had made this place what it was, and how did it still possibly manage to exist?
Lake Effect is next, but first this news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The Lincoln Hills School for Boys and Copper Lake School for Girls have become notorious in Wisconsin. Criminal investigations found excessive use of force and delayed staff responses, which, in one case, left a teenage inmate with severe brain damage. Since these investigations began, there has been talk of youth justice reform in Wisconsin. The state announced the closure of Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake and the creation of regional centers. But how do these reforms compare to the best practices found in other states? Allison Dukanovich is a former reporter for the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service whose work focuses on youth and the justice system. Her recent series of pieces compares the model used in New York to what we have here in Wisconsin. Dukanovich joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers by Skype from New York City, and she starts by explaining how the youth justice system evolved there.
In New York, like a lot of places across the country in the past 10 years or so, there was a big shift in how the state and New York City approached youth justice, a shift from these kind of large-scale youth prison institutions that were upstate and kind of more rural communities has shifted to now this kind of smaller setting with a really community-focused approach that uses a lot of different kinds of therapy and different accountability that's closer to where a lot of the young people are coming from in New York City. So kind of what happened was about 10 years ago in 2010 to 2012, there were declining crime rates among young people. There were a declining number of youth who were being sent to these youth prisons upstate. And so that meant that the cost of putting a young person in one of these facilities was skyrocketing. So it was really expensive to keep these facilities open where there were less young people. They were far from home. And then at that point, a lot of different allegations of abuse and different kind of awful things that were happening to young people in these facilities, those kind of started to surface. So people realized that that method was not working for New York's young people. It was expensive. It was, in some cases, really harmful to the youth, and it wasn't really yielding great outcomes as far as recidivism and those kinds of things. So there was this major shift to bring young people back to New York City, take them from these larger-scale youth prisons and put them in kind of smaller home-like settings or smaller different programs in the communities where they were coming from. And that initiative was called the Close to Home Initiative, and that passed in 2012 in New York.
So much of this sounds, I think, for people who are familiar with what's happened at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake, the facility up north in Wisconsin, they're going, man, this sounds almost exactly the same.
Yeah, it is very similar. And something interesting is when you look back at what was happening in Wisconsin at that time when New York closed its facilities and brought its young people back to the city and kind of tried to come up with a different approach and use these smaller close-to-home facilities. At that same time was when Wisconsin closed Ethan Allen, which was a youth prison in Delafield, so it was in southeast Wisconsin. So that closed, and so then all of the young people in Wisconsin who were in correctional settings had to move up to Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake. So it was kind of parallel timelines of when New York closed its youth prisons and all of Wisconsin's youth were moved up to Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake. And in kind of the time since then, the changes that New York made have seemed to yield largely really positive results. I mean, it definitely isn't perfect, but the recidivism rate has dropped significantly. There's a lot more positive outcomes as far as young people doing well in school and engaging in different activities. And at that same time was when a lot of allegations of abuse and the lawsuits and things came out about Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake and the expenses and all that stuff. So it was kind of these two models acting at the same time, showing that what happened in New York was then now happening in Wisconsin in a very similar way. And so now leaders are talking about, once Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake close, what can we do in place that will maybe yield some better outcomes for young people as far as recidivism and more successfully returning back to their communities.
When you look at a program like Close to Home, how does it compare to a youth prison? What do these two spaces look like?
Yeah, so aesthetically, they are very different. And that's kind of the whole point, or one of the points of Close to Home, is to kind of create an environment that there's definitely security measures in place, there's definitely accountability measures in place, and there's a lot of different rules. But other than that, it's also this home-like environment, because the whole point is to help prepare young people for when they will return back to their own homes. So it looks just like a home. A lot of the facilities are on residential blocks. One that I visited was right across the street from a school. It looks on the outside like any other home on the block. There's some more added security measures, but inside there's couches and furniture, a dining room table where the young people shared meals together. It looked much more like any other home and not like an institution in the traditional sense.
What does care look like there compared to what it would be like at a prison?
Yeah, so I mean, I can't speak exactly to the models of care used at a place like Lincoln Hills or Copper Lake, and I know that in the past couple years, especially since a lot of the allegations of abuse and different lawsuits have come up, I know there's been a lot of shift there as far as the models of care delivered. But in these homes, they focused a lot on accountability and therapy. And so all the staff were trained in this, they called it the Missouri model. And so it was really focused on group therapy and helping young people shift the way that they make decisions, the way that they communicate with each other, the way that they communicate in general, and kind of process kind of in real time. Like, everyone was trained in the same model of therapy, using similar language, trying to build similar skills. So it was kind of all throughout the day, these kinds of skills were being instilled. And then every night they had a group session where they would do different reflection activities and kind of reflecting on maybe the actions or choices that got them into the situation in the first place and different ways that they can kind of approach and problem solve moving into the future.
Something that your piece brings up is the idea of credible messengers, which is an integral part of what they do in New York with these close-to-home programs. Can you explain the idea of credible messengers?
Yeah, like you said, that's huge in New York, especially for the aftercare. But even in the homes, a lot of the people, they're very selective with who they're hiring to work in these homes and how they train them. But a credible messenger is this idea that is getting a lot of attention in spaces like this. It's the idea of someone who has a shared lived experience and then can talk about the way that they've changed their life. It can apply to a lot of situations, but what that would mean for this is someone who has had experience in the justice system, so they themselves have been incarcerated. A lot of the people who are considered credible messengers were incarcerated when they were young people. They were involved in the system in some way when they were youth themselves, and now have kind of transformed their life and have taken a different path and are working to support kids who were in similar situations that they were in. So it's someone who has that same experience can say, I know where you're coming from. I went through it. This is how I changed my life. Like, these are different. There's another way. There's another path. There are different options, and I can help you see that for yourself. So it's called credible messenger because they have this credibility of being able to say, like, I get it. I went through it too. And then they're messengers in the sense of not only just saying they get it, but they can carry that message of these are ways that you can kind of turn your life around.
Is that part of the conversation right now in Wisconsin?
Yes. At least in Milwaukee County. So I've been following Milwaukee County's plan, and there's a lot of talk, both in Milwaukee County and in the city of Milwaukee, specifically in the Office of Violence Prevention, about using credible messengers in the new facilities that Milwaukee County is working on renovating, but also in different mentorship programs and different kind of community-based programs for young people as they're transitioning back to the community, but also even before that happens as kind of a prevention support to try to connect young people with different resources and with credible messengers. So yes, it's definitely in the conversation in Milwaukee County. The official plans aren't in place yet, but there's talk between the county and the city. There also are organizations that are doing this work. So someone like Running Rebels already utilizes credible messengers. I don't know if they would put that word on it, but so much of what the work that they do is around mentorship and supporting young people. And a lot of their staff have been through similar experiences that the young people they work with have been through.
So as Wisconsin has been rethinking the way that we implement youth justice, we have been looking at a lot of the things that have gone on in states around the country, including New York. When you see kind of the plans that are now coming out, how much of that in Wisconsin really mirrors what's happening in New York?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are definitely some strong similarities, and there also are some fundamental differences. So a lot of the similarities that I've been hearing from leaders in Milwaukee County especially, and in the state, but more I've more so been following what's happening in Milwaukee County, is there's a lot of talk about kind of using a consistent model of care, using a consistent therapy model similar to what's used in those close to homes to build different skills and decision-making skills in young people. There's been a lot of talk about connecting young people to supportive adults and opportunities that will sustain after they leave placement and as they transition back into their communities. And that's very, like, that was very critical from everyone that I talked to in New York, was connecting young people to resources and supports that they could stay plugged into after they returned home. And I've heard talk about that in Milwaukee. I've heard talk about engaging family members and kind of providing opportunities for young people to connect with their families and providing resources for families to work through maybe some challenges that they have with their children. I've heard that in Milwaukee, and that was a big thing in New York. I guess one of the main differences is that New York's, from everyone that I talked to there, their big effort in bringing youth home and placing them in these homes was to decrease the number of kind of beds, so to speak, that they were using in general. So to decrease the number of placements they were making to take kids out of their home in the first place, they were really trying to either prevent young people from needing to be taken from their homes and connecting them to different alternatives. And there was just this big mindset of each home had a different contract. So if young, like, it was very easy to kind of decrease the size of the system. And that's really been happening. Like, the number of young people committing crimes, the number of young people being placed in these correctional facilities has declined. And so the number of homes has also declined. Like, their system has been able to shrink in that way. And what I am hearing right now from different counties and from the state is that they're kind of trying to match the number of beds that is kind of currently needed in these different residential programs, like, and in the correctional facilities, like in Lincoln Hills. So the big difference is a lot of Wisconsin's plans still involve kind of building new spaces, building new facilities that are hopefully, from what people are saying, are trying to try some different methods and be more therapeutic, but it's still building new facilities. And what New York was saying is that it's more about these other supports built in so that you don't need as many facilities. All over the country, Wisconsin part of this, New York is part of this, the number of young people committing crimes has decreased, and the number of young people being placed in these kinds of correctional settings has decreased. So it's this big question of, what do we do with that space if we don't need it for young people in the system? Like, how can we utilize that? I've heard from advocates both here in Wisconsin and in New York that that's a fear that they have, that some of these reform plans involve building too many new facilities, building too many beds, that people are concerned that that's too expensive and that it's kind of just replicating these older, outdated models of youth incarceration that have been shown to not be as effective. And so people in this time when Wisconsin's making some changes, advocates both in Wisconsin and in New York have expressed concern that the focus is too much on new buildings, new facilities, when that may not be the most effective use of resources, is what I've heard people are concerned about.
Yeah. Well, Allison, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you so much, Joy.
Allison Dukanovich is a journalist and former reporter for the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about her series on youth justice reform. You can find more of our conversations with the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service at WUWM.com. Coming up next, habitat fragmentation is one of the primary drivers of species extinctions. A UW-Madison scientist has some good news. We'll hear about it when Lake Effect returns, here on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. One of the greatest threats to Earth's biodiversity is habitat fragmentation. From development, including housing and roadways, to agriculture, human impact on the ecosystem is the number one driver of species extinctions. But with some help, nature can adapt to our alterations. A team of scientists has spent nearly two decades studying fragmented sections of longleaf pine savanna habitat in South Carolina. Over 18 years, they've collected small, restored patches of the savanna to one another via habitat corridors. Their efforts have brought encouraging results, including an annual increase in the number of plant species in each piece of habitat. The study's lead author is UW-Madison conservation biologist Ellen Domshin. She spoke with Lake Effect's Susan Benz about this new strategy to conserve plant and animal species and her own unexpected path to science.
Okay, the beginning is that I was a musician, and I was in college, and I went to a small liberal arts college, Luther College in Decorah, Iowa, and I was a music and communication major. And my last semester of my senior year, I took a course in environmental ethics, and that course really made me think for the first time about issues related to biodiversity, what was happening in the world, and then also what that meant for people. And it fascinated me. And I also recognized that my whole life, one of the things I enjoyed the most was spending time in nature. And so I combined sort of a curiosity and inquisitiveness that's also a part of my personality, along with thinking about this problem and wanting to solve it and enjoying doing it at the same time. So I went back to school and got coursework in ecology, all of the things that I needed to go to graduate school. And then I also had an internship at Cedar Creek Natural History Area, which is in Minnesota. It's one of their field stations with the university. And while I was there, I met a postdoc named Nick Haddad, who is also on this paper. And he had just gotten his first faculty job in North Carolina at North Carolina State and was about ready to launch this habitat fragmentation study. And at one of the lunches, we had talks every Wednesday when we were interns. He gave a seminar about this vision based on a study that they had just completed at the Savannah River site. And I was immediately captured because it was this combination of asking really important theoretically based questions in ecology about why space matters for the number of species that you see, that had also this other side of real applied relevance that managers could use on the ground. Long story short, I ended up starting graduate school with him the following fall. And I was a plant person and he was a butterfly person. And so we were both interested in diversity. And so I kind of brought the plant angle to the system and just started counting the number of plant species that we saw as soon as the experiment was set up. And now, actually 20 years later, we just collected our 20th year of data this last summer. We're able to ask these amazing long-term questions about how space affects the number of species that you see for plants.
Amazing. And there you have the story.
And there you have the story.
That's amazing. So he had the structure of the study in place. So it was,
right. As a PhD student himself, he had set up a precursor to the study where it was just squares of habitat that were connected or not by corridors of different lengths. And some of the people that had worked on that project, there was someone working on butterflies, which was Nick Haddad, and then someone working on birds, Doug Levy, who's also on this paper, someone at the time who was working on small mammals, Brent Danielson, Sarah Sargent was another person. And so they took what they had learned from that study and then helped design the new study with funding from the National Science Foundation and then also a huge amount of support from the U.S. Forest Service and Department of Energy at Savannah Riverside. Without them, this would never have happened. So a lot of us then, you know, were excited about this as graduate students and postdocs joining in this project, and we kind of got in on the ground floor as it was getting set up.
Oh, super. So we're talking about this remnant savanna, or is it oak savanna or pine savanna?
South Carolina, it's pine, longleaf pine savanna, and it is a habitat that once extended from Texas all the way through the Gulf, through Florida, and then all the way up into southern Virginia. So it was extensive across the southeastern United States.
So like 90 million acres, right?
Yeah. And there's less than 3% of the original habitat remaining, meaning that it was not put, you know, turned over by a plow or completely converted to agriculture. And then the rest of it is being restored. And there are little bits here and there that were not plowed under, but then they were typically fire suppressed, meaning that fire was not able to return at the normal interval that it had historically, which is about every 1 to 5 years. And it has a lot of similarities to other grassland and savanna ecosystems across the world. Most of these savanna and grassland communities are maintained with frequent low-intensity fire, which is very different from other ecosystems where we hear a lot about fire. I think a lot of our cultural vision of what fire is for natural ecosystems comes from the American West. And that's a very different disturbance regime where you have a huge stand-replacing high-intensity fire that happens on the order of hundreds of years. And the fire regime in the southeastern United States and for many other grassland and savanna ecosystems like tallgrass prairie and oak savanna here in Wisconsin would be a low-intensity fire that just burns through the understory. The canopy trees remain and survive. And those fires happen every 1 to 5 years. So it's a very different kind of ecosystem.
Right. So, Ellen, what you had there, or have there, because it's still research continues, right, is like two football field-sized fragments of habitat, right?
Right.
And then those connecting corridors, were those created through the study, or did they remain as well?
No, so the entire study was created from scratch. So what was there before was pine plantation, which is a very densely planted forest that has pine trees planted. And the understory is pretty depauperate. There's not a lot going on. Pine needles tend to accumulate on the forest floor, and so it's not as diverse as a savanna. So then what we did is we created these openings. In the center, there's a square opening, and then it's connected to another square by a 150-meter-long, 25-meter-wide corridor that's also the savanna habitat. And then we have a couple other patch types that are unconnected but are the same amount of area as the connected patch plus the corridor. And those two allow us to understand how corridors work, because it could be just that you end up with more habitat when you add a corridor, and really the driving factor for why you would see more species is just that you have more area of habitat. And so what we did to control for that is create a rectangle where we have a square habitat patch with the area of the corridor added on the back of it to make a rectangle, but it's unconnected. So we can compare what's happening in that rectangle to what's happening in a connected patch, and we know that if something different is happening in the connected patch, it's not due to area alone. Okay. And then we also have one other patch type, which is taking the corridor and chopping it in half and then making these two, they look like wings on either side of the square. It's also the same area, and it has approximately the same amount of edge habitat relative to core, And that's important to control for, because when you fragment habitat, you end up with a lot more edginess in the landscape. It's not just one habitat type continuously. It breaks up and becomes something else, and so you end up with these boundaries between habitats, and those are thought to drive a lot of responses. So it's a well-controlled study.
I can tell. So I have to go back to an elegant word you used, which was depauperate.
Depauperate means that there would be, first of all, low numbers of plants in the understory. You wouldn't see a lot of plants, and then also lower numbers of species of plants. So there's, if you looked at the forest structure, the savanna structure, in a pine savanna, you might see, you know, a handful of plants from a handful of species. But if you go to a savanna where it's frequently burned and the trees are much more sparse and it's being maintained with fire, you would see many, many more species, and also this rich carpet of grasses and flowering plants that are able to grow because they have enough light and less competition from the trees.
So as the study began, it was the process of identifying and setting aside these parcels, but then restoring them to, or trying
Correct.
To bring them back to its pre-European impact.
Right. And I actually think now, I mean, it wasn't the intent to have this come out at a moment like this 20 years ago when the study started, but we have just heard so much about, just in the past couple of weeks, we've heard about the declines in biodiversity in birds, for example. 3 billion birds have been lost, and the biggest impacts are actually from grassland ecosystems. And so what do you do about that when there is so little grassland or savanna habitat remaining? In Wisconsin, it's less than either 3% or 1% of the habitat type originally, depending on which, you know, subtype of grassland or savanna you're talking about. So there's not much left. So now we know that restoration plays a key role in conservation, and especially for grassland and savanna ecosystems. And so our study actually mimics what you would do by recreating this habitat and reinserting fire into the landscape and having these routine fires, and then watching how connectivity might alter the end state. And so, yes, this is definitely a restoration study and a study in progress.
So how long was it before you began to see that increase in number of plant and animal species?
You know, we actually saw it happen quite quickly. My dissertation ended by publishing a paper showing that corridors worked. And so that was in 2006. And we saw these plant species increasing in numbers quite rapidly. And then this paper, this study emerged because we wondered, well, how long will this last? It must not be able to last forever. And so we put together this proposal that, okay, like, what are the predictions we'd make? And what we've seen as a result that came out of this paper is actually the least likely outcome that we predicted ahead of time. So the fact that it's continued to operate the way that it has been really surprising.
So you're talking about, what is it, a 5% annual increase in species,
Correct.
Right?
Right. So it's the numbers sound small when you read it at first, but...
Not to me.
Well, good, because the way to think about it is sort of like your bank account, where if you put your money in maybe your checking account, you're going to get some rate of interest that's not very great. It's going to be, I don't know, 1% or less. And so you might think about, okay, well, maybe I should move it to a money market or a different kind of account because I'm going to get 2, 3, 4, 5% return each year on my investment. And that's exactly the way to think about these numbers. So what we found was that on an annual basis, the likelihood of any species arriving for the first time, so we call that colonization, was 5% higher in a connected patch than in one that did not have a corridor. And the flip side of that is that for any given species, the likelihood of blinking out or going extinct in any given habitat patch was 2% lower when it was connected by a corridor than compared to when it did not have that. And so that has compounded those rates every year for every species over time. And now we have 14% more species in the connected patches than the unconnected patches on average. And that equates to about 24 species per patch in a connected patch, more than an unconnected patch.
talk about some of those species that have...
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because if you know your prairie and oak savanna species at all here in Wisconsin, you will know a lot of them in longleaf. It's the same dominant plant families. So there's a lot from the grass family, a lot from the aster family, and a lot from the bean family. And the ecosystem is very diverse. Prairies and oak savannas are very diverse, and longleaf is incredibly diverse. So some of my favorite species are a species called catbells is the common name. It's Baptisia perfoliata. The reason it's called perfoliata is because the leaf is perfoliate, meaning that the stem goes straight through the middle of a circle. So it's a circle with a stem going right through the middle of it, and there's no indentation or anything. And it has yellow flowers. It's in the bean family, and it has these pods that explode and let their seeds disperse that way. That's one of my favorites. There's also others from the Euphorbiaceae family that have sort of a thick, milky sap, and that family is the same family that poinsettias are from. And so they have very kind of like interesting leaves, and the seeds are in sets of three, so the pods look quite interesting. There's a lot of really neat plants. And then the animals are really amazing as well. A species that we've worked on is the common buckeye, which is a butterfly that's actually found here as well. It's brown with kind of a, looks like an eye that's pastel colors, pink and blue and purple on the wings. And then there's some amazing animals, including the gopher tortoise, which is a land tortoise that creates burrows in the soil, and then an associated snake that uses those burrows for its own habitat called the indigo snake. And then an endangered species of woodpecker called the red-cockaded woodpecker that creates nests inside of mature longleaf pine trees. So they have to be a certain age before they can excavate this cavity. And that's one of the reasons that they ended up on the endangered species list. But they're recovering quite well and are really an interesting kind of bird.
So what's the next step in this work for you?
Yeah, well, I mean, we are in year six of a 10-year grant from the National Science Foundation where we're going to continue to monitor these rates over time. And like I said, we were really surprised by this effect continuing each year. And so maybe we will continue to see that for the next, you know, through the next decade. But we don't know. And then I think we also are really interested in some of both the broader implications and then also some of the mechanisms. So starting with the mechanisms, you know, why is it that these 5% increases each year in colonization rates occur? Is it something about where the way the plant moves or the way it establishes by seed in the patches? And we can do some more detailed studies to get at that. And then on the broader end, there are a lot of associated benefits, like, for example, ecosystem services is a word that we sometimes use to just mean the benefits that nature provides for people. And for example, we could look at plant-pollinator interactions, or we could look at soil productivity and soil rejuvenation as an ecosystem service. And so I think that maybe thinking about how these changes in biodiversity and the number of species might then translate to increased ecosystem services might be a future direction as well.
Ellen Domshin is professor in the Department of Integrative Biology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She is the lead author of Ongoing Accumulation of Plant Diversity Through Habitat Connectivity in an 18-Year Experiment, which was published last week in Science. You'll find more information, including a graphic comic created to describe the study, at WUWM.com. We'll take one last break here, and then we travel through a book to North Carolina and the iconic Biltmore Estate. Come along on Lake Effect when we return, here on 89.7 WUWM. More of Lake Effect now on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. There are some notable addresses and iconic homes around the United States, but one has stood the test of time and remains the largest home on U.S. soil. The Biltmore Estate, built in the late 19th century in Asheville, North Carolina, is a colossal mansion built by George Vanderbilt. The 175,000 square foot home features 250 rooms, including 35 bedrooms and 45 bathrooms, so there's never a wait for the shower. It's the stuff of legend and is the story of the people who built and lived in it. Both are chronicled in a book by Denise Kiernan called The Last Castle. She dropped by the Lake Effect studio during a tour last year and talked with me about what first led her to write about the oversized and opulent home.
The first time I went, I was actually 14 years old. My dad was stationed in South Carolina. My mom said, let's go see this historic house for the weekend. Most 14-year-olds would roll their eyes at that, but I was a little history nerd. So I heard that and I was like, yes, let's go see a historic house. When I was 14, Biltmore was quite different and a little more mellow, but still, I mean, stunning. And I felt like I was stepping back in time when I walked into the house. So many of the family's furnishings are there, tapestries, all these sorts of things. It was really, really immersive. But I never thought I'd be back in Asheville again. Cut to 12 years ago, and I'm living in Asheville. And one of the first things I decide to do is go to Biltmore House with my Jersey husband, who didn't even know what Biltmore House was, and I hadn't been in ages. And the two of us went together, and now as an adult who writes, I became really curious, not just about, you know, the house and its size, but who had lived there, who had made this place what it was, and how did it still possibly manage to exist?
Right. And there's a lot of history with this house, not just with its original owner, conceptualizer, but his family history, his wife's family history. And it's a lot of primary documents, I imagine. So what kind of research did you rummage through, and how difficult was it for you to kind of make a blueprint for this book?
Well, I write all sorts of stuff. I started out in journalism. I enjoy screenwriting. I enjoy fiction, but narrative nonfiction is my thing. And I could just stay locked in archives for hours and be happy as a clam. For this particular book, I consulted many, many different archives. And for anybody who's curious at looking at that sort of stuff themselves, you can find them all in the back of the book. Two of my most significant troves were, first, the New York Public Library Manuscript and Archives Division. That had the papers of William B. Osgood Field, one of George's best friends, and Paul Lester Ford, noted and often unknown novelist, Paul Lester Ford, whose life was sadly cut short, also a very dear friend of George. Their family members as well had papers there. That provided Field's diaries alone for he and George's travels before George got married to Edith. And as George was beginning his engagement to Edith, that was spectacular. And, you know, of course, when somebody writes someone a letter, their thoughts and feelings, their letters are often in that person's archive. So there were just the most wonderful, affectionate letters from George to Field and to Ford and to Ford's relatives on different occasions, whether it be, you know, the birth of the daughter or marriage, all of these sorts of wonderful things. Then at the Hay Library archives at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, Edith's sister, Natalie, who married John Brown, the Brown family, extremely established in Rhode Island, her papers are there, as well as her husband's and her son's. And that had a tremendous amount of family information about Edith, including when they were all just young, unmarried women. Edith was one of the main inspirations for wanting to do this book. And that for me was spectacular. I mean, I actually start the book with Edith Stuyvesant Dresser, who went on to be Edith Vanderbilt, married to George and mistress of Biltmore House. I wanted to show her as an independent woman, as a single woman, as a young woman, before she simply became a married woman, you know, married to Mrs. George Vanderbilt. And being able to sort of really get a feeling for who she was made a huge, huge difference for me. And then in addition to those, it was, you know, Library of Congress, the Wellcome University in the United Kingdom, the Beinecke at Yale, stuff all over the place. But those two and the Library of Congress brought a lot of world building to the book for me.
I do want to get back to Edith soon, but before we touch upon that, I want to talk about the Gilded Age. You know, it's post-Civil War, not quite industrialization. America's kind of in this limbo transitional period, and you definitely have the haves and the have-nots. And of course, George Vanderbilt came upon his money through his family, his grandfather, their businesses. And, you know, in the book, there's a quote, "The rich sought to conquer one another on battlefields of architectural grandeur." So what do you think set George Vanderbilt apart from his fellow American aristocrats?
Yeah, so when you think about what brought George to the Asheville area of North Carolina, I think there are a lot of things that go into it. So he's the grandson of the Commodore, Cornelius Vanderbilt, the founder of the family fortune. George's father, William Henry, doubled his inheritance and was considered at the time to be possibly the richest man in the world. George was William Henry's youngest child. George's older brothers were all interested in going into the shipping and railroad business. George was not. Like you said, he wanted to read his books. He wanted to go to concerts. He wanted to listen to music. He wanted to travel, collect art, be a patron of the arts. He had a passion for these pursuits and had the time and the money to indulge them to his heart's content. And, you know, at that time, if you were going to have a retreat, you were likely going to have it, have a quote-unquote cottage in Newport, a 60,000 square foot cottage in Newport, or perhaps something in the Berkshires. You know, you would probably travel to Paris regularly, which George did. But he was down in North Carolina traveling with his mother, and that was actually not that unusual back then because people thought, you know, this is the Blue Ridge Mountains, Smoky Mountains. People thought that the mountain air was curative. So if you suffered from symptoms related to malaria or tuberculosis, you could sit on what they called breathing porches and breathe. And this lovely little cottage industry springs up down there. So George brought his mom down there. She was being treated by a doctor, and while she was breathing on a porch, he went out on his horse and saw some really beautiful land and then thought, no, this is where I'm going to do what I'm going to do. And so when you talk about that kind of waging battles on marble floors or whatever that author would have said, George just wanted to do something a little different. And I think that because he seemed like such a quiet, private, bookish individual, I imagine that the society in New York could be so claustrophobic and so incestuous. You know, we talk about the 1% today. They talked about the 400 back then, mm-hmm. you know, the number of people who could fit into Carolyn Astor's ballroom. And that just wasn't George's scene. So I think he saw a real opportunity to indulge his love of architecture, art, and kind of, you know, get away from it all.
Well, I think that's evident in some of the design aspects, such as like the acorns and oak leaves that are the sort of Vanderbilt symbol on this massive house versus, I'm sure, other families have crests and everything.
Sure, they had to make theirs up, yeah.
Yeah, so that kind of is a testament to his personality.
Well, they, you know, it's sometimes easy for us to forget that the Vanderbilts were actually considered very new money back then. And in fact, the Commodore, George's grandfather, you know, some people just found him terribly crass and boorish. And so they weren't necessarily
old American families.
Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, they didn't have those crests that had been in the family forever.
Yeah, on the note of those little details, are there any favorite parts or aspects of the estate that stay in your brain? I mean, you're overwhelmed by so much when you visit
this
place.
You are. I think one of the most magical parts of the estate is its setting, really, is the landscape architecture. Thanks to the father of landscape architecture, Frederick Law Olmsted, he painstakingly mapped out what they call the approach road, which is the road that a carriage would have traveled on to get from the front gates of the estate actually up to Biltmore House. And it is, you know, it is winding and almost kind of, you know, just embraces you as you wander through. And you don't really see the house until the final, you know, the final turn. And you have this big final reveal. And then facing the house, you can see, you know, the mountains beyond. And it's just quite a beautiful, beautiful setting. Inside, it sounds, you know, cliche for a writer to say, but oh my gosh, that library. I love that library. It is spectacular. It's beautiful, but it's still at the same time, I think, feels very intimate. And you step in there and you can just imagine yourself, you know, curling up by the fire with a book, and just lovely.
With the designers, you mentioned Frederick Law Olmsted, who other people may know best for his Central Park design.
Absolutely.
One thing that the Biltmore Estate did before there was even any forestry service was practice proper forestry, not just profitability with lumbering, but conservation, which was especially important before, you know, national parks even
became
a thing.
Oh, my gosh. One of the things that I hope people who read take away from this, and one of the things I wanted to give a lot of attention to in this book, was Vanderbilt's and Biltmore Estate's role in United States forestry history. He brought in two foresters during his, you know, early years. The first one was Gifford Pinchot. He would go on to become the first ever chief of the U.S. Forest Service. And the second one was Carl Schenck, who was a German forester who was familiar with the European approach to forestry, which involved maintaining the health of a forest, relying on native species, reestablishing forests that had been damaged while you were simultaneously lumbering. People here weren't that familiar with it at the time because, you know, we just thought, oh, my gosh, this country's so huge, we're never going to run out of trees. So everybody just kept cutting. You know, so Schenck and George, they needed people to work with him. They said, well, let's start a school of forestry. So they start the Biltmore School of Forestry, and that is the very first school of forestry in the United States of America.
In addition to their forestry school, Edith and George, if we fast forward a bit to now when they're married, they also, you know, in kind of contrast to the opulence that this house, you know, projects, they also did a lot for the community surrounding their house and their grounds. So establishing the church, schools, educational programs, hospitals, you know, how important was it to also show their philanthropic measures in addition to this glorious opulence that is
exactly
this house?
Exactly. Because, yeah, on the one hand, you're like, oh, my God, why write about these just exceedingly rich people? But honestly, we are either approaching or we may have actually surpassed the income disparity that existed during the Gilded Age today. But when you look at people like George and Edith, who, I mean, just you named a few things. They started a school for domestic science that, you know, young women could go to learn how to work in fancy rail cars or in nice homes, giving them jobs. They helped get the YMI off the ground, the Young Men's Institute, which became the Center for African-American Culture in Asheville. They built a hospital. They built the parish school for employees' kids and local kids and sent their own daughter there. They built a church. They helped establish the crafts school and eventual business Biltmore Estate Industries. And all of these things, in addition to, you know, the things you might expect from someone at a high level of society, like, you know, found charter members of the American Red Cross and donating to war efforts during World War I and all that sort of stuff. But there was such an intimacy, especially for Edith, the way that she gave. She wasn't just, you know, writing checks. She would host, you know, the bazaar in the village. She would get on a horse and have a basket with a blanket and food for an employee who was sick or the spouse of an employee who was pregnant. It really endeared them, especially her, to the community. And, you know, honestly, if people with this kind of wealth all behaved that way, the world would be a pretty okay place,
right.
I think.
They were very unique in their English estate concept of having a village and a grounds and a self-sustaining operation. This wasn't just, here's my house that I go on vacation to.
Yeah, they really did. You know, there were some hits and misses in the sustaining part for them financially, for sure. But I think also especially deciding to have their daughter Cornelia, she was born in 1900, deciding to have her there instead of going back to their place in New York or going to see her family in Newport. Having Cornelia at Biltmore House, you know, in North Carolina, I think really cemented their relationship with the community.
And also Edith had a big role in cementing their relationship with the community after her husband's death. But you have this interesting arc of how she's viewed by the public, you know, starting from coming from a family who was relatively well-known and respected, but not big money necessarily.
Sure.
And kind of a surprise engagement to most people, or they wouldn't find it suitable. So with her striding between the two worlds of Victorian opulence and then coming down to North Carolina for, you know, so-called country living to what the Vanderbilt estate was, what do you think made her and George such a great pair to do this kind of work together?
That's a great question. In many respects, I think I think they both sort of walk to the beat of their own drummer in a sense. Edith and her sisters and her brother as well, but he was a little older, suffered some difficult losses early on in their childhood. I think it made her a rather resilient, wouldn't make everyone that, but I think it made her a rather resilient, independent, strong woman. She was raised by essentially, you know, after her familial losses, she was essentially raised by her governess. So I think she felt a real affection for people who did not have that same kind of New York blood lineage that she did. They were so important to her in her life. And George sort of was happy to be away from the New York scene as well. I think they had travel in common. I think they had philanthropy in common. And I think they each had just enough of a, if not desire, satisfaction and ease at living away from the very claustrophobic world of New York society.
To finish up here, I'm going to read you a quote from your book. "So many remnants of that age were already crumbling under the weight of their sumptuous guise, opulence yielding to irrelevance. Biltmore still stands today. It's still owned by the family, but it's welcome to visitors. How has the estate's role changed, and what do you think people should take note of it in today's world?"
It's astounding that it is still standing and that it is still essentially in the same setting it was all the way back then. There might be cars driving around or tour buses and restaurants and that sort of thing, but it is a rare opportunity to actually kind of immerse yourself in a very, very different time. It's easy to get distracted by that, not distracted by the house. The house is, you know, one of the main reasons people go there. But I would encourage them to not just look at the extremely gorgeous gardens and fountains and things surrounding the estate itself, but if you go down there, go into the village that once housed people who worked there and the Cathedral of All Souls that George had built for the community, and go a little further afield and go into Pisgah National Forest and look at some waterfalls and enjoy some solitude, because if they had not rejuvenated those forests and protected them, you wouldn't be able to do that. So I always tell people the house is great. The setting is amazing. I'm a huge believer in how significant it is historically. But go a little further afield and see the legacy of what they didn't build.
Well, your book is certainly a good start if they can't make it directly to that location. Denise Kiernan, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Denise Kiernan is the author of The Last Castle, the epic story of love, loss, and American royalty in the nation's largest home. She spoke with me last year, and I share a photo of me with my family at Biltmore from, let's say, several years back. You can see that at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and you can join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.